You're listening to a 95BFM podcast.
So my name's Rob Orchard. I'm the co-editor and co-founder of Delayed Gratification, the slow journalism magazine.
I'm going to ask you what that is first, but I'm interested too in your background. Sort of, how did you find yourself to be the editor of a magazine? And what, I mean, are you a journalist?
I'm a journalist, yes. I've always been in magazines. So I met all of the people that I set this magazine up with when we were all working our first jobs in journalism in Dubai in 2002. So we were all working on Time Out magazine in Dubai. And so I was the restaurant editor, and my co-editor now, Marcus, was the film critic. And there was kind of a group of us. So we all were working on this print magazine, beginning of our kind of careers, and falling in love with print and falling in love with making magazines and doing all the stuff that you do when you kind of get your first job. So working through the night and, you know, like very, very, very narrowly getting into kind of, you know, to print deadlines and stuff like that, and writing good stuff and writing bad stuff, but having the kind of the rough edges knocked off us. So we did a lot of that, and then we all kind of went our separate ways and worked on different things and for different companies, and we all ended up back in London in 2010 when we were all just turning 30, and we were all kind of looking out over the media scene, I suppose, and it was incredibly bleak. And we just, you know, it was this time when everybody was saying that print was dead, you know, digital was the future, even though nobody figured out how to make any money out of digital. And huge numbers of journalists were getting laid off, and it was all just looking pretty bleak. So we wanted to, the reason we made this magazine was to put a sort of a flag in the sand to say, no, there's, you know, there's definitely life still in print, and there's definitely life in good journalism, and people will still be kind of prepared to pay for it. And it was a kind of a bit of a gamble that we made that took quite a long time to pay off.
So when you say bleak, I mean, that's not only to do with money, I guess, and funding print journalism, but it's bleak in the sense that you felt news wasn't being done properly?
Well, I think what we felt was that news was being hollowed out. So it all came back fundamentally to the economic underpinning of the whole thing. So, you know, news had been a business where it was possible to make lots of money and to fund really, really good journalism. And to do it even at a kind of really local level, you know, the UK used to have a fantastic, and I imagine the same thing with New Zealand, used to have the most fantastic network of local newspapers. And because they could make money, you know, out of classified advertising and out of copy sales, they could support investigative local journalism. There was some amazing stuff. And not only that, they could provide a way through. So, you know, young journalists would have a pathway. They could start in local newspapers where it was relatively easy to get taken on. And then, you know, they'd find some nice editor who kind of take them under their wing and train them up. And then they start sending stories to the nationals. And then there was a pathway and a progression. But we saw all of that kind of being completely cut out. And the reason was because the economic underpinning was destroyed by the internet. So the internet basically, you know, made the dissemination of local news kind of far less important in terms of local newspapers. It meant that none of the kind of advertising that propped up local news made sense to kind of have it in print, you know, a week after it was first commissioned. First put in, it ripped out the kind of the legs from the kind of the commercial part of the business, and that, you know, that was replicated in the national newspapers as well. You know, the nationals, they took this kind of bet early on that actually what they could do in this brave new digital world was just to put all of their content online, and they could reach such a massive audience if they did it for free that they could then just make a huge amount of money through advertising. There was a bet that didn't kind of pay off. And then by 2010, when we were looking out over it, you know, nobody knew how to make money out of journalism anymore.
Okay, I want to come back to the internet, because that's quite fascinating, actually, saying that, you know, the internet, which we see as this thing which was amazing and is amazing, but it's actually ruined something else.
Pros and cons.
Yes. Okay, so I guess just to start really at the start, what is Delayed Gratification?
So Delayed Gratification is a quarterly print news magazine, launched in January 2011. And what it does is once every 3 months, it draws a line in the sand and it looks back over the big events of the quarter and it asks the question of what happened next. So we like to return to stories after the dust has settled and the rest of the news media have moved on. And we like to do in-depth reporting on those stories. And that can take any number of different kind of forms. But so, for example, a classic story for us would be we sent a journalist back after cyclones Kenneth and Idai went through and absolutely ravaged Mozambique earlier in the year. We sent a journalist back a couple of months later to see what life was like on the ground. So after the, you know, the kind of the news spotlight has very firmly moved on elsewhere, after a lot of the NGOs have packed up, after a lot of the promises of, you know, of donations and of money have actually proven, you know, not to have actually taken place, we sent the journalists back to see what the situation is like on the ground. But not just that, but just to put that situation in context and to look at things like the disproportionate impact of climate change on countries like Mozambique, but also the impact of corruption. And so she traveled around the country and brought back this extraordinary 6,000 word story that that makes you realize that at the time you just skimmed the surface of what was going on with this story.
So when you started that, that was kind of your initial, your thinking. I'm wondering though, I mean, I'm obviously coming to this very late, 2019, it's been, you know, 8 years. How has the magazine evolved since inception? Have you had to kind of adapt?
Well, do you know what? You can look at, you know, kind of the first couple of issues of the magazine, and fundamentally it's exactly the same thing. It's got exactly the same purpose. We have more money to invest in it now. So we're doing bigger and more ambitious stories, and we're sending people to kind of further flung places. Definitely also, there was some mad stuff we were doing in the way that always happens when you start a magazine. You know, you can't work out what's wrong with it until you get a few issues out there. So, for example, the first couple of issues we printed in a tiny font. It was like 7.2 font. Wow. And it was just because we had so many words and we were so determined that it was going to be value for money that we just put, I mean, put, you know, like a 3,000 word feature on sort of three pages. It was insane. And like one of the first kind of sort of set of feedback comments that we got from people were just like, I think it's a good magazine, but I can't actually read it. Like the design has evolved, it's become more sophisticated. We've always done beautiful infographics. Those have become kind of more sophisticated. But generally, no, fundamentally, nothing's kind of changed. I think what is interesting to me is that when we launched it, it was a proper niche title. So we kind of go on kind of radio stations to talk about it, and it was kind of the novelty item, right? Oh, like, so here's a news magazine that reports on the news 3 months later, you know, ha ha ha. They say that they're proudly last to breaking news, which was always our tagline, ha ha ha. But actually, I think what's changed is not so much the magazine, but actually the sort of the environment in which it operates, where actually I think people are, I think it's becoming much less niche. I think people are seeing the value in slower, more considered, more perspective-driven news coverage these days.
Yeah, and that's, I mean, that's fascinating in itself, kind of witnessing that change, because one of my later things I sort of touch on is that I guess, you know, my assumption would be that there isn't necessarily a majority demand for this. But like you say, there would increasingly be that, right?
Yeah, absolutely. It's always going to be a question of sort of, you know, it's always going to be niche. So it might be a bigger niche, but it's always going to be niche. It will never be a mainstream title. You're never going to sell, you know, 200,000 copies of it, you know, at newsstand. Or at least, I don't know, maybe you will, but I don't think so. And I definitely don't think it's going to go properly kind of mainstream. But that said, I think people are, I think there's a series of things going on. I think people are much less in love with digital than they were back in January 2011. I think then we were totally enamored with our kind of smartphones and what they could do and what the digital world kind of would open up to us. And we were sort of super excited at it. And I don't really think that we'd seen the kind of the downsides. I don't think we'd seen that we would all become like low level addicted to our telephones and find it very difficult to be away from them. And then we certainly didn't predict the kind of the rise of misinformation online and fake news at the certainly not at the levels that we've got them at the moment. So I think that has kind of shifted. And I think also there's a shifting awareness that when you get, you know, anything for free, particularly, you know, journalistic content for free, then, you know, there's compromises inherent in that. You know, that people talk about, you know, if you're not paying for the product, then you are the product. And, you know, I think there's a greater awareness that if you want something that is balanced, that it's independent, that it's high quality, that, you know, it invests in the sort of journalism that you want to read, you're going to have to pay for it.
And I mean, I don't know what I honestly, because, yeah, I don't really buy magazines. I don't know what a general or average price would be, but I feel like this is fairly affordable.
Ah, well, that's an amazing. That's amazing that you say that's wonderful, because, yeah, so we've not changed the price since we launched.
Wow.
Yeah. What? So it's like it's £10 an issue, or £36 for a year subscription, or actually, sadly, that, you know, for New Zealand, we do have lots of lovely New Zealand subscribers, it's £55 for a year subscription. So we haven't changed that. And I remember the outrage at the beginning, £10 for a magazine, £10 for a magazine. but now that's you're right. I mean, actually, in terms of independent magazines, that's very reasonable, because, you know, we were, I suppose, we were part, the very earliest part of this boom in independent magazines that's happened over the last decade, and that has completely altered people's kind of perception of what a reasonable amount is to pay for a magazine. You know, there's magazines that I bought that were, you know, £25, £30. You know, that's kind of been completely changed. And of course, independent magazines have their own sort of economic models as well, based around sort of small print runs. Many of them don't have adverts and so on and so forth.
And I acknowledge that obviously that I'm in a position to pay something, you know, which I think is, I'm in news. So this is something that it's a kind of an investment for my own career, I suppose, in a way. But yeah, I can acknowledge that for some people it might not be reachable. And that's why I suppose the internet was, that idea of the commons and being able to access whatever. But now, because of that, there are other powers at play, I suppose, that are taking advantage of that and exploiting that. I mean, I do want to go into sort of misinformation and fake news. So I'm going to go back, though, because I want to just deal with the basics. And I want to know, how do you actually select what news you cover? If you're dealing with an entire 3 months, or, you know, 1 month at a time, which is the way you kind of break up the magazine, how do you choose?
Well, so it's editorial decision making in exactly the way that it operates, you know, in every newsroom, which is trying to find kind of an assortment that makes sense as a package. So there's certain key events that you got to cover. So, you know, like the cyclones in Mozambique, the terrorist attacks in Sri Lanka. These would be kind of big, you know, key stories that you need to kind of go back to. The fire that burnt down the spire of Notre Dame and almost consumed the entire cathedral. These are kind of key things that people are going to want to see some sort of coverage from us on. But then also we have this lovely liberty that we can kind of roam quite far and wide. So we can cover stories that, you know, got very, very little coverage, but that we think were kind of overlooked and that were important. We can bring in historical stories that give kind of a load of context and perspective to what's happening these days. And also there's all sorts of, you know, very subjective decision making going on. So, you know, we can constantly look at the flat plan and updating it. And sometimes we'll say, do you know what? This is all looking too depressing. We just need something jolly. We need something jolly in here, because we've got a really big depressing story here and we've got a really big depressing story here. We need something fun in the middle. So we do kind of quite a lot of stuff like that. Or, you know, we've got no sport. We need something on sport. So just kind of, I guess I've always thought that the really good magazines, the magazines that I really love, are not made by editors who are constantly thinking, how do I hit this demographic, or how do I hit this kind of people that, you know, so that the sales department can sell adverts to this marketing group. But I think that they're made by editors who make the magazine that they themselves want to read, and they sort of bloody-mindedly keep making it, and they hope that an audience coalesces around it. And that's exactly what we've done with Delayed Gratification.
Moving, I guess, into more deeper discussions, you did a TED talk in 2014, I believe, where you used news headlines as examples of basically false news getting distributed. And there's so much to unpack there, but I might just start by asking, do you have problems with headlines generally?
Yes, I do. So this all comes back to the damn internet. Internet's ruined everything for everybody. But so I remember at one stage of my career, I was helping set up Time Out Paris. And it was really exciting. And we kind of went in, we hired a load of French journalists, and we gave this kind of big inspirational speech about the values of Time Out, which, you know, kind of values of telling the truth and pulling no punches and not being beholden to anybody and so on. And then we got this person to come and give a talk about SEO. And, you know, you had this room full of journalists who were all excited and kind of like, you know, pumped up about everything. And then this SEO person kind of came along and started talking about headlines. And how you can't have, you know, like you can't have puns, you can't do playful headlines, can't do anything enigmatic or teasing or anything like that. It's just got to be clickbait, basically. And you've got to have a certain number of mentions of a certain number of keywords. And, you know, the same goes for your articles. And I could just see this room full of journalists deflating, and I was deflating at the same time. So I think, yeah, there's that side of it, which is that, you know, it takes quite a lot of the life and the spirit out of the kind of art of headline writing, which is always quite a fun art. But also, of course, in this new, brave new kind of online economy, the only thing that matters is clicks, right? Because clicks drive the adverts which fund the journalism. So actually, you get involved, you know, even if you have the best intentions, you get involved in a race to the bottom where you end up putting in provocative headlines, headlines that sort of, you know, blur the truth in order to sound more shocking, and sometimes outright nonsensical headlines. Just because those are the, you know, this is the economics of the internet. These are the metrics that, that govern, you know, whether you're going to be able to continue paying people. So that's pretty grim. And then there's whole kind of subsets of that. So we just did a funny little piece in the new issue that we're working on at the moment about this brilliant Twitter account, which is it's at Just Says in Mice, and it's this scientist who's got fed up of the awful quality of science reporting, and of particularly the thing that he particularly highlights is headlines that suggest that some great breakthrough has been found out about humans, when actually it hasn't. It's in a preclinical stage and it's only been found out about mice. So like all he does is he just takes a link to a misleading headline and a misleading story online about a science story, and he just puts in capital letters, "Just says in mice." And it's very good.
That's very clever.
So yeah, so that's kind of, you know, I think there's that sort of stuff going on as well.
Yeah, and I mean maybe taking it back to the hollowing out of news perhaps, but I wanted to also touch on when it comes to headlines, it's also on it's partly the agency of the person consuming the information, right? So there was a piece that came out here a while ago, an opinion piece talking about, you know, it's actually on you, person who's reading the news. You're the person that's going to be clicking this thing. Just don't click it, basically.
Yeah.
So how much do you think that, you know, I mean, there is obviously this dumbing down of news happening, but what's the sort of the obligation or the responsibility on the consumer? And I use consumer very deliberately.
Well, that's fascinating. Yes, I think there's arguments on both sides. Yes, you could say that we all need to become smarter. And if we want to be informed citizens in, you know, when operating in an ecosystem where there are people who are blatantly out to try to, you know, feed us false information, then yes, you know, the onus is on us to be about to be smarter about it. On the other hand, it's all very well for people like you and me to talk about that sort of thing, because we're immersed in news and we talk about it and we think about it, and we, you know, like when we go out with our colleagues, we kind of like rack our brains about it. And, you know, most people just don't have that time or that luxury. You know, most people are just getting on with their jobs, and then at some point, you know, they want a 20-minute, you know, little kind of like update, so they know what's going on vaguely. And they probably don't want to be involved in sort of triaging sources to try to work out, you know, whose agenda's at work and stuff like that. And the other thing, of course, is that, and I forget exactly the percentage, but there was this study that was done that suggested that a bafflingly, worryingly high percentage of people who share links to news stories on social media do so without having read the story underneath. So they see the headline and they share it. So a couple of people did a funny kind of thing on that. And they put up a bogus highly provocative but kind of highly false headline, and the story underneath, the second paragraph just sort of said, if you read this far, I should tell you that none of the above is true. But it still got shared incredibly widely. And you can say, you know, well, nobody should ever share anything without having read it first. But that's just not taking account of human nature. You know, that genie, that social media genie, is not going back in the bottle anytime soon. So we have to, I suppose we have to kind of deal with the world as we find it rather than as we wish it were. So, yeah, I guess primarily the onus is on us. But you know, yes, the onus is on us to do that. Sorry, I'm talking myself around here. But also the economic imperative works against that.
Yeah.
Because if you write sober headlines, if you always say, you know, like in mice, for example, then you're going to lose out clicks to the person who doesn't say in mice. And with, you know, with the whole industry so precariously balanced in terms of kind of, you know, like, a lot of people hemorrhaging cash, a lot of people just sort of just about kind of breaking even, very few people actually making lots of money, then, you know, it's really difficult to take that broader view.
And so we are back in the circle to the sort of political economy of it and the monopoly, I suppose, of the industry, as well as the speed of consumption, which is encouraged.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. You know, we have built ourselves, you know, logically and step by step, a system that sort of militates against what most people would see as our best interests.
Mm. Okay. I don't know if you've read James Ball's Post-Truth book.
No, I haven't heard about it.
Okay, he uses in this book the example, and he calls it bullshit, basically. He talks about bullshit, and he uses the example of misinformation by the Leave campaign during Brexit as a problem for a functioning democracy, essentially. So the example is that, obviously, the Leave campaign talked about the 300 and something million pounds or something that would come back to the NHS if they left the EU. So that was in the news, and so he uses that example as the misinformation which was given to citizens in that this amount of money would go to the NHS, and then the Remain campaign had to then respond to that and say no, that's not entirely true. Yes, there is that figure, that number of that amount of money, but it's not just going to go back to the NHS, and this is why. And so they spend all this time trying to kind of break that down, but the damage has already been done. So, yeah, so I mean, obviously this is a problem, right? And especially if that's going to happen all the time and lead to, well, I mean, the Brexit referendum being the example of a thing happening where people are not actually fully informed as to the consequences of it.
Yeah, I mean, I suppose that's quite the sort of £350 million to the NHS is quite an interesting example, because people have always made bold and unverifiable claims in elections and in referendum campaigns, right? You know, I mean, you know, to a certain extent, any politician who stands up and says, you know, under me, we will cut taxes and increase public spending, has to be taken with a pinch of salt, right? And right. And at some level, you hope that the kind of the electorate is sophisticated enough to see through that sort of thing. I actually think that the sort of the falsehoods that were going around during the referendum campaign were actually much more pernicious than that, because yes, there was a big bus driving about the place with something that's fairly misleading on the side of it. But actually, the sort of much more worrying thing was the individually targeted campaign bits of collateral that were being sent out through social media, and that were making some quite extravagant claims, and that were employing sort of dog whistle tactics, and that were not being served up to most of the sort of people who might report on them, because most of the people who would report on them were not operating in, you know, those sorts of areas online, I suppose, because they would have, you know, all of the people that they followed would have had kind of like-minded view, that the algorithms would have known that they were kind of, you know, probably more of the liberal kind of the left-leaning characters, a lot of them. But anyway, they wouldn't have been served up these sorts of things. So that feels a lot more worrying and insidious to me than a claim on the side of a bus.
Right. Okay. Back to the internet.
I basically sound like I've got a vendetta against the
internet. Yeah, you do. And it seems like you're almost trying to get people to buy your magazine because it's not the internet.
Almost as though I had some sort of vested interest in printed word.
Fair. But okay, well, that is a very valid point, right? The author of the book, well-known, very well-sold book, Sapiens, he said that fake news has been around since the Bible was written. So yeah, this is not a new thing, and politicians making claims is not a new thing. But where does news come into this, and what role does it play in sort of spreading that?
Well, so the kind of the classic newsrooms have got their work cut out, right? Because for almost all of the time that we've had news, editors and journalists have been used to being the sort of the filter through which events pass, right? Through which kind of knowledge is disseminated. And that's kind of an incredibly privileged monopoly to have. Obviously kind of the internet and the advent of social media, but also the advent of anybody being able to put any story up anywhere in the world and share it with everybody in the world, and kind of virality and what drives virality and so on. With the advent of all of that, not only do newsrooms have to continue to try to be economically valid places while spending less and less and less on the kind of the good journalism that's actually likely to make people engage with them, but also they have to kind of almost fight this rearguard action against nonsense. I remember coming across the very first examples that I saw of news websites that had been created to look exactly like super mainstream news websites. So, like stuff that looked exactly like the Washington Post and had the fonts of the Washington Post. But, there was a slight kind of change in the headline and the masthead, and you didn't necessarily read it until you kind of got halfway through an article. You're like, why is this such a strange sounding article? Oh, now I kind of realize that. So sort of trying to fight a rearguard action against that. But of course, I suppose what that sort of thing has meant is that there has been a decline in public trust in the media overall. And, part of that comes back to, people not having enough time to do all of the sort of, the thinking about sources and about, what different types of media are. But actually what they see in their Facebook is a load of, stuff being served up to them. And some of it is from reputable news sources that fund journalists and do proper journalism. And some of it is from absolute nonsense, people with completely different agendas. With partisan agendas, with sort of hardcore commercial agendas, who are actively seeking to put nonsense out into the world just because it drives things forward for them. So that's incredibly difficult. Yeah. So there's this sort of like this education process that needs to go on at the same time, this rearguard action against fake news and disinformation. But I feel like it feels a bit like it's being lost.
And I guess then it just sounds like, there's just the stalemate, basically, because it's not like, I know journalists that don't want to do the news that they have to do, like they have to do this certain story, or they have to write it in this certain way, or that sort of thing. But this craft isn't about that, really. It's about telling the story, telling the what happened and why and what this means. So I guess I'm come back to that my point where I assumed there wasn't yet a majority demand for slow journalism, and whether you think that there is, or are there any solutions beyond slow journalism?
Slow journalism is very, very attractive type of journalism for most journalists, because you're absolutely right. Most journalists get into it. They don't get into it because it's going to make them rich, because it's not going to. But they get into it because they have a desire to tell truthful stories that matter, right? And so whenever I go and talk at journalism colleges and so on, I'm always really, really enthused by how many young people still want to go into this, right? But also at the same time, I'm apprehensive for them because there's no obvious pathway for them to kind of get into it. The competition for the jobs that remain is incredibly fierce. And a lot of people who end up getting jobs where they just have to churn stories out to feed the beast. You know, they have to do kind of, you know, 6, 7, 8 stories a day. And that just means that there's no time to properly research, to talk to anybody, to kind of canvas expert opinion, any of that good stuff. And you know, a lot of people as well who are kind of directed in the choice of their stories, not by their instincts or by tip-offs or anything fun like that, but by what people are searching for, you know, online the night before, you know, the editor comes to talk to them. And so they have to kind of, they have to feed that into their stories as well. So that's a pretty poor lookout from that point of view. And so from the point of view of journalists want to do good stuff, then slow journalism is super, super appealing. And, you know, I enjoy doing it immensely. I enjoy having sort of 3 months to really get to grips with the story. And I enjoy sending journalists off for, you know, for a good period of time to really kind of do something justice. But whether that will become something that people very widely want to fund, I don't know. But I do see people investing in it more. And, you know, I do see them finding success in big stories. And, you know, kind of, you know, this really kind of invested stuff. That said, I heard a really extraordinary example a while back. So Mother Jones had done this really terrific piece of work where they'd sent somebody undercover to work as a prison guard in a private prison. And they estimated that this fantastic story, which really kind of blew the lid off what was going on in America's private prisons, it cost them $350,000 to put together.
Wow.
You know, so like a really major, serious invested piece of work. $350,000 to put together. They put it up online, and the advertisement that it garnered, you know, even though like so many people were seeing it, but the advertisement revenue it garnered was $5,000. There's no business on earth that can afford to do that, right? That can say on a, you know, regular basis, yep, yeah, we put in $350,000 of investment, and the return, yeah, I mean, the return was this amazing story and $5,000. It's just not possible.
Yeah. Wow.
Yeah, sorry.
So, I mean, that's the thing, right, is that there's the powers that be at the moment are these the advertisers and the data and the algorithms which allow for that. So actually, while we're at play in this system, you're not really going to win.
Yes. I think that's exactly right. When we're operating within the system, we are not going to win. The free online content and you know, online advertising model is no good because the kind of the roster of products that people have to advertise on is constantly increasing. So the rate of the advertising that you can garner is constantly decreasing. So that's not a sustainable model. But, you know, there are lots of projects kind of popping up. So in the Netherlands, there's a project that has done exceptionally well called De Correspondent, which has a similar sort of approach and philosophy to us, but it's digital only. And it's completely walled off digital system. So you can only kind of be part of it if you've paid and if you're a member and you're a subscriber. And they practice this sort of open journalism where they, you know, they really engage with their readers and subscribers. They get tip-offs from them. They canvass them, you know, if they need expert opinion, they kind of go out to them and see if there's anybody who knows anything on the story. They work with them on the story transparently, and then they kind of publish it. So there's models like that that are springing up and that will continue to produce good journalism. A lot of newspapers have now put up paywalls because they've, you know, decided that they've come to the end of their tether with this free content model. And that seems to be helping in some circumstances. And then, of course, you've got things like The Guardian, which has managed to sort of square the circle. So they were losing tens of millions of pounds a year a few years ago, up until very recently. And they just went out to their readers and said, look, this is expensive. This journalism costs money. If you want us to keep doing stuff like the Panama Papers, you know, and the Paradise Papers, and you want us to report on stuff that matters, then you need to put your hand in your pocket. And then, you know, a million people have done and they've started to break even. So it's not all doom and gloom.
No.
And the pendulum always swings back, doesn't it? You know, yes. I mean, you go through this kind of time of thinking that digital's amazing and digital's everything and it's kind of the answer to everything. And then, you know, people's tastes change and so on. And then actually people find that there's a massive renaissance and flourishing in print, which is much easier to make money out of.
I guess I wanted to touch on that, that you just saying, I just want to acknowledge too that you guys send this out in recyclable paper.
Yes,
and it's all, yeah. Because that's another thing, I guess, is print doesn't, or digital doesn't have the same sort of damage to the environment, I guess, but it totally does in different ways. So I'm not going to go down that that route.
No, but that's completely fair. That's a completely fair and valid point. I think, you know, I think what that just does is it means that if you're going to print stuff and ship it around the world, then you just need to make it something that's worth hanging on to.
Yeah.
You know, something that justifies it. So one of the things we've always done with the magazine is make it, or try to make it, collectible. You know, it's kind of, it's beautiful, it's advertising free, it's got a kind of an artwork on each cover. If you, you know, for the kind of the dweeby kind of like collectors like me, if you line all of your magazines up, all the spines kind of align in the kind of, there's a kind of a design that moves in and out among them, which is kind of lovely. But yeah, you know, I think increasingly, if you're going to be doing that sort of thing, then A, you need to make it as environmentally friendly as you possibly can. Mm. And B, you need to make it worth the paper or you know, worth being printed, I think.
Yeah.
But you're right as well also that there's, you know, it's not that digital publications are completely environmentally friendly. They are immortal. They live on dozens of different servers around the place. And actually, if you're just putting up loads more nonsense, then, you know, that's much harder to justify.
Okay, coming back from that tangent and just you mentioning those other models, and this was something I kind of, I wanted to explore, and it's not necessarily a question, it's more an observation, but delayed gratification in its concept, or, you know, in its function, is not necessarily unique. You know, there, I'm sure that there are many things which kind of do a similar thing, given that there'll be lots of minds around the world who have considered this. I was raised, so I'm Pākehā, which is the sort of Māori name here for New Zealand, European. I don't know how much you know about New Zealand, but my first language was actually Māori. So I grew up in a Māori worldview, I suppose, and that's not very, it's much more common these days, but not as common when I was younger. So growing up and going through media school and everything, I had this other worldview which I was operating through, and learning all these issues about news media, or just about the media in general and that sort of thing. I was often, I suppose, critical of the fact that the way that we do news here is, you know, everything that was set up now and the way that its functions and the structures came through a colonial inception, I suppose. And so there is a certain way of in at the most base level, a certain way of telling stories, which is very different to a Māori way of telling stories, which, because in Te Ao Māori, or as if you're a Māori person, you are always functioning not only as yourself, but as the past, as the future. You're always telling stories in that sort of circle, which means that you are always providing context and you are always asking what's next, right? To use the words that you were talking about in this way. And so when you learn about the equilibrium, right, or the way that a news story has a conflict and then a resolution and that sort of thing, and then when you apply it to an issue which is kind of specific to a certain group perhaps, and then the conflict might be a completely different conflict once you understand the context, right? There's a different starting point to the story and a different end point to the story. So me coming into news media, I was like, oh, you know, this is obviously the problem. We have to be, you know, more critical of the way that we are telling stories. And so context for me was just the most important thing, right? So this, yeah, I guess I'm just kind of rambling now, but I'm wondering, you know, the structures themselves serve a very specific purpose, I suppose, especially here, and the agenda in which news is produced, is written, is given out, you know, all of those things come from a certain place and don't necessarily serve all people. So I don't know, yeah, it's just an observation, but I'm wondering, the more that we have which explores different ways of telling stories and more critical, more in-depth things, the better.
Yeah, totally. There's a series of points there. So number one, I have been to New Zealand. New Zealand is my absolute favourite country in the entire world. Number two, you're right. Slow journalism, you know, and the setup of delayed gratification. There's nothing new about it at all. I mean, slow journalism is really just kind of shorthand for good journalism. And the only fact that you need to kind of, you know, you need to package it up and say it's slow journalism is really just because, you know, we've moved away so much from all of that stuff that should be obvious. That, you know, you should give journalists time to do what they do properly, which is research up in depth and try to serve, you know, up a proper approximation of the truth, rather than just kind of pushing them and pushing them and pushing them to turn stuff out faster and faster in greater and greater volumes. And finally, yes, it's a fascinating point about storytelling, because, of course, there's no place that is not someplace. So you can say, I am, you know, like, this magazine is nonpartisan, it's independent. We always strive for it to be that. But of course, all of the editors who write it have biases, both conscious and subconscious. We're all from a place, you know, we all kind of grew up in a culture and so on. So there's no way to make something completely independent and kind of completely free of any sort of form that's been imposed on it. And the other thing, of course, is that if you know as a journalist that if you want to get people to engage with something, then the best way to do it is to tell a really good story. And a lot of really good stories tend to have kind of, you know, the same sort of dramatic structure. You know, they've got characters, they've got a journey, there's struggles and, like, you know, tribulation along the way, and ultimately there's some sort of resolution, hopefully some redemption. And in stories where you don't have that, where it just starts off bleak and it ends up bleaker, and everybody's dead and it's all awful at the end, well, all that ends up happening is people just don't read them. You know, they turn off and they don't engage with the other stuff that you're trying to do. So you're absolutely right that there's a lot of structural stuff that is inbuilt, you know, in journalism, even the best journalism.
Thank you for responding to my ramble. But
not at all.
I'm sort of wrapping it up, but I have a couple of, and I suppose this question would have fit better earlier, but you say that you ask, and, you know, as part of creating the magazine and writing these features and stuff, you say what happened next, right? What, you know, what happened after? So you return, but how does that work in politics? Because obviously, you know, there are things happening every day, and actually it's fine. I'm sort of answering my own question, because reading the magazine, and when you go through at the start of the month, you give the what happened on each day throughout that month, and it's quite funny because you point out when something that happened earlier or something, you know, something changes about that later. So I guess you do get that sort of context. But I'm wondering, would slow journalism, I suppose, and I'm going to use these two examples because they're the examples in that post-truth book I mentioned, and I guess examples which affect a lot of the world. Do you think slow journalism would have resulted in different outcomes in the US presidential campaign of 2016 and the Brexit referendum?
Wow, that's really interesting. So you're absolutely right that there's certain stories that, you know, it doesn't make sense to talk about what happened next because the story is constantly unfolding. So we did a massive big package of Brexit coverage after the referendum. So we just kind of like took the temperature of the country after the referendum. We looked at what the kind of the dividing lines were that had been opened up across the country. And, you know, we talked to people who were kind of bound up in the referendum and what happened. So all of that kind of happened. Since then, we've done very little coverage on Brexit just because it is a constantly unfolding, never ending journey of distraction and upset, and it goes on forever, and it's broken my spirit, and you know, and it's very difficult to kind of give any kind of proper conclusion. A classic story that would fit into the kind of what happened next mold would be the terrorist attacks in Sri Lanka, where you had kind of blanket coverage by the international media for several days, but almost no follow-up of the reprisal attacks that happened in the aftermath, and how the country is trying to kind of pull itself together and face up to a kind of very divided legacy that it has from the Civil War, and you know, and this kind of massive kind of religious divisions that have spilled out recently. So anyway, so and then in terms of slow journalism and, you know, what would have been, I mean, I suppose definitely I feel that it's the case that if everybody, you know, who end up voting in the US election exclusively read sort of sober, seasoned, like, non-partisan analysis of the candidates, then we probably wouldn't have even ended up with Clinton and Trump, you know, like on the ballot paper, because during the primaries, probably different people would have won. But of course, that's just pie in the sky. And, you know, that's just not how kind of the world operates. I mean, I suppose, you know, in terms of the way that we do kind of what we call slow journalism, actually, it would all have been terribly confusing because we only report stuff on stuff 3 months later. And I always say, look, you know, you can just read delayed gratification, because basically, you know, like every 3 months, you just come in for a hell of a surprise. You'd be like, so what's happened?
Yeah.
Boris Johnson is prime minister.
Yeah.
a trade war, you say? But, so you've got to, you know, it's a compliment to your kind of your daily diet of news media. And of course, I'm as a sort of addicted to kind of, you know, to daily news and rolling news as anybody else. But yeah, I mean, I would love to think that in a different world, I mean, you know, I think probably in a different world with different reporting and so on, you know, when it comes to stuff like the referendum, then actually the referendum might not have been called in the first place, because the referendum being called was a kind of a response to political pressures that were being generated by the UK Independence Party, which in turn was being fueled by a lot of misreporting over many, many years of what was going on in Europe and what Europe wanted and how, you know, what Europe's attitudes were towards becoming a federalist state and all that sort of stuff. So, I mean, yeah, wouldn't it be lovely? But it's not the case.
Not the case, no. And I guess my final question, which it's, I suppose you've kind of answered it, because you have to engage with daily news. You can't sort of not keep up with what's going on on a daily basis, and as you say, the magazine acts as a compliment. But I guess, yeah, my final question is, do you think that we should get rid of instant news completely?
No. I mean, there's occasions when it's incredibly useful to have that kind of that rolling 24/7 feed, right? So if you're you know, if you're in the middle of an earthquake or something, you want to find out what's going on, you want the latest updates and so on. If you're in the middle of election night and you want to see the results kind of coming in all the time, then all of that can then be very useful and very addictive as well. And no, you need to have that kind of, you need to have those regular updates as to what's coming on. I suppose the thing that destabilizes us and throws us off balance is the kind of what I would describe as the white noise of information that's coming to us that is packaged up as news. So if you kind of open yourself up to it on kind of social media, and a huge number of people do, then you are just inundated with information left, right, and center. And it's very difficult to parse it, to kind of work out what is valid and what is kind of from a credible source and what is nonsense and what is biased and what is outright kind of lies. And I think that kind of that thrum, that constant never-ending thrum of information, quite a lot of it dubious, it just also makes us, it devalues the kind of the proper news organizations, and it makes us lump everybody in with them. And it makes us, you know, say stuff like, we did this thing in the summer. We had an exhibition. It was last summer at Somerset House in London, where we're based. And we put up an infographic, because, as you know, we love doing infographics. And it was just, we just plotted people's age against their level of trust in the media. And then we gave them stickers. We gave them a sticker for print media, for online media, for TV and for radio. And we got them to put their age and their level of trust in the different media up there. And it was quite interesting, because actually there were certain trends that you could spot and so on. But the thing that really struck me was some of the conversations I had. So I had a conversation with a lady, very kind of nice, educated lady, in her 70s. And she had stuck a thing about broadcast news with a very, very low trustworthiness rating. And I said, oh, that's interesting. You don't trust broadcast news? And she said, no, I don't trust any of them. You can't even trust the BBC anymore today, can you? It's all nonsense. I didn't sort of pick a fight with her. I was like, no, that's not true. The BBC is all nonsense. You're absolutely wrong there. But, you know, the fact that people think that and can kind of lump everything in together, oh, it's just, you know, you might as well listen to anybody or nobody because it's all exactly the same, that's really worrying.
That was a 95BFM podcast. Support 95BFM with a B-card. Go to 95BFM.com/signup.